There have been recent developments regarding Operation Kino.
Hello, welcome to Operation Kino number 139, the review episode for Friday, November 15th, I think it is, 2013. Today we are talking about Nebraska, because not much else is coming out. But Nebraska is a fantastic film, at least one of us, or two of us, or many of us
Martin
might
Scorsese
think so.
Martin Scorsese did a pretty big favor to the best man holiday in Nebraska by vacating the weekend.
That is true. Although I will say, and maybe I'll expand on this when we outro, Best Man Holiday is pretty solid too. But we're going to concentrate this week on Nebraska. And to help us out, since it's David and I, Katie bailed, Dave is not here, we have Keith Ulick of Time Out New York. And he's a member of the New York Film Critics Circle. So he'll be passing judgment against this film when it comes to voting for big awards at the end of the year. Keith, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Matt. I appreciate it.
Keith and I got to see Nebraska at Cannes, at the Cannes Ooh. Film Festival. Ooh. I think we were sitting right next to each other, very excited.
Oh, yeah.
As we did many mornings in a half awake, but many films woke us up.
Yes.
I don't know if Nebraska was one of them for you.
It was always a pleasure to see your face in the morning.
Yes, I know.
Patches is a morning person. It's quite unfortunate.
I know. I was very
he's a lot more
awake.
Chipper than you are, and he holds it against you. He's a terrible human.
And with French coffee, the caffeine. Whew, I was on. But let's dive into Nebraska here now. I'm going to jump to David first. For a positive opinion, someone who didn't see this at Cannes, someone who saw it after the buzz a little bit, coming at it from a different perspective perhaps than the two of us.
Yeah, why don't I set it up a little bit?
Yeah.
For those who may not be familiar with it, this is the new film by Alexander Payne, who I would suspect most of you know from films like Election and Sideways, and most recently The Descendants. And it's adapted from a script by – or it's not adapted, rather. It's directed from a script by Bob Nelson, who whose previous credit was writing for Magic Johnson's variety show, The Magic Hour, and who wrote this script.
You are so proud of getting that factoid out of him.
It's factoid. It's like his entire IMDb page. It's not all that elusive. But he wrote the script in 2003, and it found its way into Alexander Payne's hands. And Alexander Payne said – I would love to direct it, but I'm going to do some other stuff first, and cut to 9 years later, and it's finally hitting the big screen, much to Bob Nelson's delight, I'm sure. It's the story of a guy named Woody, who's played by Bruce Dern, who is senile, but it's certainly, if it's clinical, it's not diagnosed. He's sort of in and out. You'd say he's maybe engaged in 20 seconds of every minute as to what's going on, but he's a bit... certainly getting a bit old, and he receives a letter from the Publisher's Clearinghouse that tells him, with an asterisk that he overlooks, that he has won $1 million, and he believes it is his. And so he asks his son, who's played by Will Forte, to drive him from their town to Nebraska, across, which is, you know, a road trip of a couple of hours, to collect the money. And so they drive from one dreary part of Middle America filmed in black and white to another. But on their way, their car breaks down and they find themselves in the town where Woody grew up and where everyone seems to have remained, including some members of his family and some other people. And it's very Twilight Zone-y in its own way, despite the fact that it's not the tone. The town is sort of lost in time. As that sort of
yeah, that little kid who thinks people to death. That was a weird, real twist.
You're right. The woman, Woody's old flame, runs the local newspaper. There's a guy who's played by, what's his face? Someone help me out here. It's escaping me.
Stacy Keach.
Plays a guy who's sort of his old nemesis, who has some sort of underhanded money dealings that he hears the news that Woody is now a millionaire and everyone takes him at his word and wants a piece of the pie. So sorry, with that very long verbose setup out of the way, I was afraid from the tepid reactions out of Cannes, of which you two may have been responsible, I don't know, that
partially responsible.
The first Alexander Payne movie that didn't really do it for me. It seemed at once both the most obvious of Alexander Payne movies, he being from Nebraska and telling another story ostensibly about what critics of a negative bent may refer to as yokels or whatnot. I don't know, it seemed like this may not have been a home run, but as a story of a father and son, as a people learning to not anything necessarily about themselves, but learning to see the people who are most important in their lives through a different lens and sort of recasting the pivotal roles in their own lives. I thought it was really beautiful. It's as frank and wry as anything that Alexander Payne has made or likely will make. But much like his other films, and is very much an Alexander Payne film, even though it's the first film he didn't write of his, it has a tender side as well. And the last moments in particular, I thought, were just so perfect and as strong as anything he's made. So I was very, very positive on Nebraska, surprisingly so.
Technically, he did not write The Descendants.
Well, he adapted it. He wrote the screenplay. He was really hands off with the screenplay.
I thought Jim Rash and the other guy wrote The Descendants.
He gets a credit for.
They won the Oscar for him.
If Alexander Payne doesn't get a credit for Nebraska, then I made an asshole out of myself to Alexander Payne. So.
Well, I'm looking it up on IMDb, and The Descendants. He does have a screenplay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So he did tweak this one a little bit. He claimed to me that he was responsible for the ending that I love so much, but it seems like for the most part he was hands off. Mm. What say you guys?
Yes. So I'm now throw it to Keith, because it's interesting to hear you be so positive against that canned reaction, which I admit that I was kind of so on it after seeing it at Cannes, but then rediscovering it at the New York Film Festival, I was kind of shocked to have really been moved by it. And I don't know, maybe the scene of Cannes where I'm just kind of like stumbling into movies and waiting for them to really blow me away kind of took a little magic away from this really.
There must have been something that made you go back.
I think there are minor tweaks. I think it's a little sharper in this new edit from Cannes. I think it really breathed in the Cannes version and a little too much. It just took its time. And I lost Will Forte in the movie because of that in the Cannes cut. And in this new cut, I think Will Forte becomes a more important character. And it's more observational on his part. And actually, Stacy Keach, I think, gets a few more moments, perhaps, in this version of it. He felt like a more vivid character to me as this kind of adversary from an older life. But yes, Keith, throwing it to you, you were not too pleased walking out of this movie at Cannes.
No, and I mean, I guess we should specify once again that I've only seen the Cannes cut. So, you know, sometimes the smallest tweak can change something. I wish I felt like I wanted to revisit this, because I really don't at all. I just thought it was probably, it was the worst thing I saw at Cannes. I feel like it might be.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. Just in terms of my experience of
Did
it.
Did you see Jimmy P?
I like Jimmy P.
Oh my God!
Yeah, I know, and that's the one that really is more disappointing. I don't know about this negative reaction out of Cannes on Nebraska, because I mean, aside from I guess my review, and I think a lot of people, you know,
maybe
really
your review
liked
just
it.
Carries a lot of weight with me.
I don't know why, but I remember like Mike D'Angelo really loved it after having not loved a lot of Payne's recent movies. I seem to recall even people, you know, who were not like effusive about it, at least giving it, you know, some measured sense of praise or whatever, or singling out Bruce Dern or something like that. You know, the line that popped into my head as I was watching it that I then immediately put into my review was, I called it a rank exercise in exploitation sentimentalism.
Oh, no.
Did you then drop the microphone and walk out of...
Whoa, yeah.
So you're leading the charge of this is an unfair and demeaning portrait of...
No. That was the line that came to mind while I was watching it. And I knew when I was thinking that, I was like, okay, Payne often gets this, you know, criticism. of caricaturing, you know, Midwesterners or and everything. And now there's like a kind of uprising on Twitter right now that's kind of pushing back against, you know, the East Coast critics or whatever who are protecting the poor Midwesterners from Alexander Payne. And so there's like this little kind of, you know, Twitter brouhaha brewing, which of course tempests in a teapot and everything. But in my review, I mean, I started with that line, and then I feel like I went on to kind of say, look, you know, he gets tagged with this and it's not always fair. You know, I'm a big defender of The Descendants, actually, which seems to me to be a film that a lot of people don't like now. Maybe didn't like at the time. And for some reason, that's the Payne film that everybody really seems to hate. And I thought it was beautiful.
Would you agree that his films have a tendency to grow on you, though, especially over repeated viewings?
It depends. The Descendants I've only seen once, and I really liked it a lot, and I don't know what I'd think of it. I think Election certainly is extremely strong, and all the times I've watched it, I've been very impressed with it. About Schmidt, I've only seen once. I guess I would say some of it has lingered, and I'd probably need to revisit to kind of figure out what I think. What's after About Schmidt? Sideways. Yeah, which I'm not all that keen on, but ooh, you know.
That's my favorite.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
Yeah, but you know, there's. I don't think. What's after Sideways? Is it the Descendants?
Yeah. It took 5 years.
It took his time.
And Descendants is the one I'm kind of cool on too. I was cool on it when I saw it,
but it's definitely the cable, the endless repetitions on cable.
Yeah,
warned me too.
It's gone through the 40-year-old virgin process for you.
Exactly.
The only thing I really don't like in the Descendants is how he treats Judy Greer ultimately. You know, I feel like she's kind of like a punchline ultimately in that scene in the hospital at the end where Clooney kind of just pushes her out of the room and everything. But everything else about the movie I was really impressed with. And so, you know, I feel like he is often unfairly tagged as kind of this caricaturist. But I think that I do find that when artists get tagged with a certain thing, there's a reason for it. And, you know, it can be used as an easy fallback, but there's probably some measure of truth in it. And for some reason, I found I don't want to say caricaturing because it sounds like I'm being negative. I found the heightened nature of us, of the performances here in Nebraska to be very off. You know, it was just one of those things, like right from the first scene, everything just felt off to me, from the old time 70s logo to, you know, which is kind of getting to me to be an annoying tick. I wish people would stop calling back to the 70s, as I said in the review, and just kind of make movies for their own time and stop being embarrassed about it. You know, you live now, and it's kind of like I've had enough. I'm kind of sick to death of like, oh, the 70s in American cinema. Oh, couldn't we go back? No, we're not going back. We're here. So come on and just make a movie for here. You can make a drama in its time, and it takes place in the present. You know, so it's not like, you know, but there's still kind of that affect that logo kind of sets up, you know, and it annoys me in Soderbergh, too, a lot of the time.
Right.
You won't have to deal with that problem anymore.
Yeah, well, I don't know. We'll see about his miniseries.
Yeah, what was the Starz logo like, or the Cinemax logo like back in the 70s? The 40s.
He did that in Behind the Candelabra, and it didn't bother me there. I mean, you know, because I love Behind the Candelabra ultimately. But, I mean, you know, that's another discussion. Anyway, I mean, but, you know, right from that old-time logo with Nebraska and then just going into it, there was just something that was really just off about it for me. And, I mean, in the review, you know, I tried to point out, you know, I say, look, I realize Payne knows this place, knows these people. I don't doubt they exist. I don't doubt that, you know, he has some insight into that. But, you know, there's knowing your subject and then there's executing it. And the execution of this just really rubbed me the wrong way, like across the board, especially.
Just because he plays it for laughs, or is there something like devious and strategic to you about that, because it's interesting to hear you call it the performances in this movie heightened, because they feel very true to me as someone who has, you know, gone to visit my grandparents and my cousins and my extended family who lives in a rural part of this country, and then all of a sudden we are having that moment where we're all sitting around the television like dead-eyed or having these conversations about nothing or about like gossip about people I've never even heard of. It's like, why are you telling me this? And I felt like I was in the room with my family again watching Nebraska.
Grown-up Buzz, whatever that actor's name is, who is now having a bit of a resurgence between this and Blue Ruin, I mean, he and his dopey brother definitely felt, you know, like they're certainly played for laughs, but something. I mean, go on.
No, I was going to say when I said heightened too. I mean, I was more talking about like the supporting characters around, kind of like Dern and and Forte, June Squibb especially, who I feel like if anybody would get a supporting actor Oscar nomination or something, she would be the one that they'd probably single out if it goes that way. She's just so big and broad and everything. And
women swearing, man. People love it.
And I mean, you know, but she also kind of epitomized, you know, what was wrong with the movie to me, like especially in that scene in the graveyard where she flashes the grave, you know, and it just it's a joke, and but it's also meant to carry, I think, some level of sadness about loss underneath it all. And it just, you know, it did not work for me at all. Hmm. You know, I said in my review that it's like I felt like I was watching two movies that, like, one was sugary, one was sugar, and one was arsenic, and they were blended together.
But
and
it's,
I felt like I was being
It feels
more like frosting to me, because the core story between Dern and Forte works so strongly for me. And really, you know, I think when I emotionally connect to films, it most certainly doesn't always the crux of that isn't always about how much I can relate to it or not, at least not in an obvious way. But I certainly related very strongly to the dynamic between father and son in this film, and thought that it was incredibly accurate beyond the milieu and the particulars of middle American life. I think the way that generations communicate to one another or don't, because and the way that communication can break down even when there is sort of this reservoir of love between them, really rang true for me. And so when you have June Squibb having an amusing, if not necessarily fitting, outburst in a cemetery, you know, for me it was like a song and dance number in the middle of a great drama. You know, it was like a Bollywood musical, and here we're having the dance scene. So it was, and I thought it was cute. I didn't think it necessarily added sort of meaningful depth to the story as I was enjoying it, but nor necessarily rounded out Woody's character. But I didn't see it as a distraction so much as a compliment.
I feel like that moment's really necessary, and I'm only now just having this epiphany that Nebraska is kind of like Back to the Future, in that it's about a guy who's forced to go back to a time when his parents were young, or discover this life that he didn't really know that they have. I mean, it's obviously a muted, a more introspective version of Back to the Future. It doesn't have the sci-fi trimmings, but I mean, it's the same thing. We need to see Bruce Dern's Woody kind of have this dynamic again with Stacy Keach, or we need.
You may want
to
put the possessive on that.
Sorry, Bruce Dern's. Maybe I'll just refer to him as Woody. Yikes. That moment where June Squibb goes and flashes the grave. I mean, I'm seeing her as a teenager again. I'm seeing her as this wild child that she is, and that she's been so repressed, kind of living this mundane life elsewhere. And now they're all back in the same town. They're reliving this life. It's so exciting. And I think why Will Forte really struck me the second time I watched it. I think the first time, he felt kind of like he was just breezing through, you know, it didn't feel like he was having an impact on the action. And suddenly maybe it was a few select reaction shots from him, but I'm like seeing the observations, I'm seeing the understanding, I'm seeing this like tradition of oral storytelling coming out and sweeping over him in this movie, and it's so riveting to see him have that understanding. What are his parents really like? He's now back in their shoes, living it out with them.
Yeah, so I mean, what I'm hearing is that basically, like, the elements cohered for you, whereas for me, you know, it was like I saw nothing but elements that were not cohering at all, and so, you know, it was just, like, for, I think one of my biggest problems is that I just thought Will Forte was god-awful, and I could not, I thought he had no, he was not connecting with the drama, like, at all, and could not convey anything that needed to be conveyed, and I was just kind of like sitting there slack-jawed, like there's, I was just like, you were totally throwing me out.
Do you remember a moment from the film that stands out to you, having that disconnect?
Like right away, like when his girlfriend comes in, I think at the beginning, or the ex, isn't that right? Like
Alexander Payne's standard overweight girlfriend characters.
Yeah,
or that's what Jeff Wells would call her. I think most would say the overweight.
Nice save there.
Hollywood movies.
yeah, but I mean, again, I think this comes back to the thing of, you know, when there's a reason this stereotype of Payne as a stereotypist, you know, forgive me, has gotten started, and I think it all depends on if you feel like, you know, the vision is complete, or if it's just like, you know, these disparate elements that don't cohere. And it's weird for me because some of his films do cohere and others do not. And so it's like, you know, just kind of have that thing where you're saying, you know, oh, he's always a stereotyper or something like that, and just kind of to like peg him like that is a mistake. You know, but I still feel like, you know, there are times where it's like, yeah, now I can see why people say this. You know, but you still need to go a little bit deeper on it. But anyway, to bring it back to Forte, I mean, yeah, right from that first scene with the overweight girlfriend, it was just like, I don't even remember what he was saying because it's been a long time since I saw the movie. But I mean, I do remember just him kind of standing there saying these lines and just totally, to me, not connecting at all.
Well, do you think that it would have been easier for you to get into the character had it not been for his background in SNL? Because I think that for me, at least, eventually I warmed to it, it's hard not to see his characters.
No, because I don't watch SNL. And so I have, I know he's MacGruber and all this, but I don't care. I mean, look, you know, there have been comedians who've done,
of course,
you know, drama and everything. And it's like, if you can do it, great. I don't really have much history with Will Forte. I don't think I'd even really seen him outside. I mean, you know, I'd seen a MacGruber skit here and there, just like on YouTube, but I didn't really have anything invested in it. There was someone who was positing, I just wanted to say that I think they were kind of down on the movie too, and they said they kind of wished that Bob Odenkirk had played Will Forte's role.
Yeah.
And I kind of wonder about that, because of course then, you know, I'm more invested in Bob Odenkirk personally, you know, too, because of Mr. Show and Breaking Bad. So, you know,
and I probably would have brought some baggage along with that.
Yeah.
He plays Woody's other son, who is more successful. He works as like a local TV anchor. Weatherman, right?
Weatherman.
Sorry, go on.
No, I mean, it's just, you know, it's one of those what ifs that really you can't say would that really have worked or not. You can just sort of speculate. Well, personally, you know, I think I might have more connected with that, and I'd almost rather see Bob Odenkirk and Bruce Dern interacting than Will Forte and Bruce Dern, or at least this version of Will Forte.
Why, you know? I like
now
Forte.
You accepted us with the idea.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, getting out of my head.
I like Forte over Odenkirk here because I need Will Forte's character, David, to have room for ambition. I feel like someone older, it might be either settled into their way of life or on their way climbing already. Mm. And he feels stagnant, but he feels like he has the possibility to go places. He can still learn things because he's a slightly younger man. And having Odenkirk kind of bounce off him as this kind of older brother figure, I mean, that's what I need Odenkirk for. And I mean, I'm glad he's in this movie because he's like a perfect fit for the Payne world. And so is Forte. Yeah. These guys, they're not like stars. They don't stick out like a sore thumb against all these kind of like normal people, quote unquote. but they certainly play off each other, and I was glad to have that dynamic.
It's difficult for the Forte character because he's sort of, along with Woody, at the emotional fulcrum of the story, but at the same time, he has to be sort of a vessel for us and our window into this world, and I think that the flatness that Forte brings to it is what Payne was looking for, and I think that it's ultimately effective. But yeah. I think that this is one of those cases, and I'll be the first to admit this, where the absolute sublime perfection of the ending and the last shot in particular undoes a lot of damage and really sort of rights the ship and casts a really warm sort of afterglow that when I look back on this movie, even upon first viewing, which is somewhat unusual for me with a Payne film, I have such warm regard for it.
Yeah, I felt like I was being injected with, like I said, arsenic and sugar. So I at the end I was just like, I have to register one other complaint about this film. I have so many, but the one I really have to say is that fucking score by Michael Horton.
No, no.
Oh my god!
I love it. I adore it.
Yes, it sticks in your fucking head. It sticks.
It's on iTunes right now. You can go buy it if you like.
It's like the worst. It's like the worst sort of elevator music, just sticking in your head, and it's like,
wow.
Oh god! I as I was sitting there, it was in the big theater in Cannes, and I was just like, I was like, this score is so awful. And telling me every beat of what it wants me to feel, and I just want it to stop, and it won't stop, and it keeps going with the same melody with different instruments, and I hate you, Mark Horton.
That's so funny, because I feel like the score intentionally does that to you, and then kind of releases, like, later in the film. It adds to itself, and kind of comes to life.
Ugh.
This is going to be so off-topic, but I think I did not feel that way about the score at all. I felt the score was very sort of consistent and just had the sort of sameness that proved sort of a bellwether for the emotions of the characters. But the way Tatchis was describing it about how it releases you, I was thinking, have you guys seen Labor Day?
No.
No, and I'm avoiding it like the plague.
Oh my god. At the score, that's a score that tells you in advance, like a horror film almost, exactly when you can breathe. Exactly what to think at every moment. I think for me, that's what you're inferring, and the Nebraska score did not function like that for me at all.
Yeah, it feels so reflective of the environment and the mood and the action of the film, that driving, that long drive, is even longer because they won't drive fast enough. I don't know, it was perfect.
Well, the good news is you'll know within about 5 minutes whether or not the score is going to be a problem for you, or if it's something you'll really enjoy.
That is
true. Yeah, no, I knew within a minute or two.
Keith checked out very early. To kind of wrap up, I feel like we've overlooked Bruce Dern a little bit in this conversation, and because he seems to be such, I've seen the film, he's a very important character, but his performance is kind of garnering raves from a lot of people. I'm curious what you guys thought of him. You know, when the first time I saw it, I didn't think he was doing a lot. You know, he's kind of playing this senile old man, and he's just acting like a wacko. The second time I saw it, I really thought there was dimension to him. You know, when they start having conversations about his drinking problem, as many movies that touch alcoholism and that sort of thing over and over again, we become desensitized to the issue, perhaps, at least as a dramatic tool in a movie. Mm. I just thought he was peeling away at just the right pace this entire film, and I was really getting a sense of what perturbed him and then what kept him going in life later, you know, when he keeps going back to his drive to get this money to fulfill this prize.
And I loved how it was sort of never a magical senility where he had these moments of clarity where he said very wise things and then, you know, faded back into like, oh, who are you? I mean, it was this very consistent sense of just sort of being 20 or 30% there. And what's so interesting about the character is that he might be the only character I guess it could be argued that of George Clooney's character in The Descendants at times, but he more than maybe any other Wes Anderson, Alexander Payne character, has a very clear want. And what's so interesting about that is that he is senile, and so everyone is mocking him for what he wants and is sort of driving the.
I don't know, Tracy Flick had a pretty strong one.
Tracy Flick isn't really who I see as the. I think more of the Matthew Broderick characters who I think of when I think of Election. But yeah, and so I think it's that really interesting thing that keeps that tightrope like performance on point is that he's sort of he knows what he wants, but he's not entirely in his own head. And I think it really keeps everything together. I think it's a great performance. The movie wouldn't have worked without it, but he nails it.
My turn.
Take us out.
If you have a comment on it, Brewster.
Only to say that I don't think he embarrasses himself like some people in the movie, but I you know, it's one of those things where I feel like I'm seeing the you know, the history of the actor more than the history of the character, and it just feels very weak tea to me. I felt kind of the same with Stacey Keach for whatever reason. Again, since no element was cohering and I didn't really feel like there was a character there, all I got was kind of like Bruce Stern acting wacky, like you were saying.
I didn't love Stacey Keach singing In the Ghetto?
In the ghetto.
No, you know, give me Stacey Keach in like Escape from L.A. or something like that, you know, or is the voice of the villain in Batman Mask of the Phantasm.
Wow.
Or something like that. But
I'm
reaching a lot of things here. But I mean, yeah, it's just one of those things like Dern is fine. I feel like he's done so much better work so many other places, and this is just like, you know, he's sort of been out of the spotlight a little bit, and now this is the kind of thing like, oh, we can give the old man an award. Okay, fine, you know, he's a great actor. He is, and, you know, it's like he deserves all the accolades, but, you know, I mean, the more interesting, like, old man performance of this year, I suppose, for me, was Redford and All Is Lost, you know, if we're gonna start
Don't start David on that one.
Yeah, if we're gonna start judging things on that, you know, and I mean, I don't even really want to make the comparison of, like, old man performances or everything, you know, it's just like, you should, it's like, whatever your age.
Venus,
you know,
with like Peter O'Toole or whatever, where it's a nothing movie. That is your prestige. I think Bruce Dern, and I say this to someone with an appreciation of who Bruce Dern is, but not necessarily a fandom. I'm not sure how actively I could recall his more famous roles in my mind's eye, at least. I really started fresh, as fresh as I could with him in this movie, and I thought he worked marvelously. And I try to remove myself from the awards conversation as much as possible, which is often not very much. I think that he would be, I would not bat an eye if he walked away with prizes.
Nor would I, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, awards are stupid. You know, they help a little bit, I guess, in some superficial way. But I mean, ultimately, you know, it's just like they're paperweights. So it's just like, I mean, Bruce Dern's career is set because he's put in a lot of work and a lot of, I think he's one of those that actually we're going to go back and we're going to discover some things that maybe have fallen out of the spotlight. So, you know, I think he's one of those, you know, kind of like the character actor who actually, you know, does have some, you know, performances that, you know, you could really go back to. I just feel like this one, yeah, it was like, again, there was so much, you know, over the top that was going on around him that I just kind of felt like, well, you're kind of more a center of calm here and you're not embarrassing yourself like Will Forte for me. So it was just like,
you at least like the black and white photography, right?
I hated the black and white photography. I just thought I said it looked like it had the consistency of curdled milk.
Oh,
you know, or the textural quality. Excuse me, looking at the review just to make sure I quote myself right. But I could not stand it. And apparently, I think from what I understand, it was post converted from color, which I know the Coens did
That's pretty much standard with digital photography.
That's what Bombeck did on Francis Ha.
I think the Man Who Wasn't There was shot on film, and they post converted from color film. You know, if if we're thinking
they don't they don't make many video cameras that shoot in black and white. Just FYI.
Yeah. So I mean, but it's weird because, you know, I mean, I love like Coppola's Tetro, which I think might be similarly, you know, shot in color and post converted to black and white. I'm not actually even sure, but I love the textural quality of that, and that's a digital movie. And for some reason, this one though, just I could not stand the way it looked, and you know, it's possible that the reason I couldn't was because I just wasn't connecting with anything that was happening. You know, ultimately it's one of those things where, like, you know, if all the elements work for you and you're all connecting with it, I mean, you know, I'm glad, you know, and I can.
There's your pull quote right there.
But I can understand too with Pain, and it's why I kind of wanted to, even though, you know, I started off that review with the Hicksploitation thing, I wanted to say, look, he may get tagged with this, but it's unfair to just fall back and like just tag him with that as like a scarlet letter and leave it at that. You know, there's more to it than that, and it's interesting to kind of like see. I forget who said it again on Twitter, but, you know, someone said, like, it's interesting to see who likes what Pain movies, because there doesn't necessarily always seem to be an exact pattern as to who likes what. I don't know.
I'm in the rare position of liking them all.
But didn't you say you were kind of cool on The Descendants?
No, I really like
it. No, that's me.
Cool,
that's me.
Initially.
That's you.
Okay, I need to revisit it, okay. I guess.
So you see, I mean, yeah, it's some like them all, I guess some don't like any at all. But I think there's more people around who are kind of like maybe a little bit more mixed, and I guess that's where I kind of come in. I mean, this one, for whatever reason, you know, I mean, I think I've laid out the reasons ultimately, but it just really rubbed me the wrong way. So yeah.
Keith says no. David says yes.
Yeah, Nebraska, absolutely.
Essential viewing of 2013, I would say so, absolutely.
Depending on how many titles you fit into your best of the year list, I would say one of the best of the year.
That's your pull quote.
As the snow flies on a cold and gray Chicago morning, a poor little baby child is born in the ghetto. And his mama cries, 'cause if there's one thing she don't need, is another hungry mouth to feed in the ghetto. In the ghetto. People, don't you understand?
And just to let you know, the other movie, I guess, coming out this week is Best Man Holiday. Only I have seen it, so I can stand alone and praise it. I'm so happy to say that Best Man Holiday. I took a chance. I wanted to see. I was anxious to see Best Man Holiday, having not seen Best Man, the 1999 film, the original. And I was pleasantly surprised. It's basically
it's like
a Nancy
seeing Desolation of Smog without seeing The Hobbit.
How will you understand? No, actually, well, hopefully the Desolation of Smog has a 10-minute montage that juxtaposes now and then clips to kind of fill me in.
I hope not to break the embargo, but it most certainly does.
Oh boy! David has seen Desolation of Smog.
I have not seen it.
Oh, David has not seen Desolation of Smog. To break it down for you, Best Man Holiday, it's basically a Nancy Meyers movie, but done well and with black people. So I'm happy to say that black people can have white people problems too. I was just very, it was such a
That's
good
a
movie.
Great,
yeah, it was such a great movie. very funny, raunchy, very R-rated. Terrence Howard, he's back, baby. No one would ever have assumed that. So I had to let you know, Best Man Holiday, worth seeing. Let's jump to our lightning round question, which was in honor of Best Man Holiday. What movie from 1999 would you like to see a completely unexpected sequel to? Keith, since you are our guest, do you have an answer here?
Yes. I'm going to say, if I may, first The Straight Story, where basically Harry Dean Stanton and Richard Farnsworth are just sitting on the porch talking for the entire time.
I hope that's the movie that brings back David Lynch. Straight Story 2.
Yes, Straight Story 2. I would also love to see a sequel to Go. whatever go.
As long as Doug Liman doesn't have to direct it.
Go harder or go faster?
Goer.
I don't know.
Going?
Goer. Go.
Went?
Going, gone. There you go.
It'll turn into the Fast and Furious franchise soon enough.
So just as long as that annoying kid from The Shining isn't in it anymore.
But, oh. You
know. Yeah.
David, do you have a listener answer here?
One of our favorite listeners, Ryan Silverstein, Silber whatever. But Ryan, who is lovely, I'm very upset with. Because, I don't know. He picks Mystery Alaska, which, as he observes, is about a former New York Ranger, played by Russell Crowe, who cannot skate, who moves to Alaska to coach the hockey team, which, now I'm adding, it takes the Rangers to overtime in the exhibition game they play at the end of the movie, which is utter horseshit because I don't care how often you play hockey in Mystery Alaska, you are not going to be competitive with a professional hockey team, no matter how bad the Rangers were in the year 1999. So it's a terrible and deeply offensive movie. And if maybe Ryan is proposing a sequel because he wants to see justice acted out on screen and the Rangers just embarrass Russell Crowe, who so obviously can't skate. It's worse than any of the Mighty Ducks movies.
From the director of Austin Powers.
Right. So if that's what Mr. Silber, whatever, is going for, then by all means, I endorse a sequel to Mystery Alaska.
And I am going to go with, oddly enough, a lot of people said Magnolia for this. What are people thinking there? I'm at a loss for what the sequel to, is that just more people doing
stories,
interactive stuff? I can't picture Magnolia 2.
They clean up the frogs, you know.
Oh, yes. It'll be like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs too.
Well, I think there's such a velocity to that kind of movie when it's done well. Like, I was just rewatching Nashville a few times, actually, and while the story, the movie's almost 3 hours long as well, and all the stories have more or less been resolved in their own way, but there's just such a life force to it that you want to see more, even if the point's been made. So I
feel like Todd Solondz tried to do this and failed, so I'm not sure. Yeah. I would request Magnolia.
A slightly different tact.
All right, fair enough. But what I'm actually going to go with, also a lot of people said Mystery Men, and that's completely baffling to me, but I'm going to go with @OnBFilmsTony, who said, not completely unexpected, but South Park, Bigger, Longer, Uncut, which I think is one of the most fantastical musicals of all time. And of course I want another South Park movie. I guess I don't know what it would be, and I don't know how they could top themselves, but I'm sure they could figure it out and put it together in like 5 days. So yes, bring that on as soon as the rights. I think there was a big rights issue either last year or 2 years ago where Paramount was like using the South Park movie rights to bargain for, I don't know, some other blockbuster tentpole nonsense. So it's lingering somewhere, ready to be made, hopefully. And that about wraps things up for this episode of Operation Kino. Why don't we tell the people where they can find us, starting with our guest Keith. Where are you on the internet? How can people connect with you?
I am, you can find me on Twitter and Facebook, but you can also find me at Time Out New York. You can just do timeoutnewyork.com and take you to the main page, and you click on the film section and you'll find me there. I'm also linked on Rotten Tomatoes, and you can just search my name, UHLICH. It's very uncommon last name, so you'll find me pretty easily.
You're also on Letterboxd.
Yes, I am.
Is that something people tell people?
Yes, absolutely.
Wear that proudly.
Letterboxd, Keith Hulick, and I always write under my own name. I've made that. I do not post anonymously, and I haven't since 2000, I think.
What were you posting anonymously as in 2000?
I actually wasn't. I was on the Brian De Palma forum under, just kind of like a letter thing. But I always signed my name to each post because I just felt like, it was the right thing to do.
Brian De Palma would want to know.
Yeah, he would want to know. So,
David.
I am David Ehrlich. I am the senior editor of film.com. You can find me at film.com, the actual website. The name is right there in the title. It's very handy. And also on Twitter, at David Ehrlich and at film, DOTCOM.
And I am Matt Patches. I'm writing across the internet, trying to put everything on mattpatches.com. I'm on Twitter @MrPatches. And that about wraps things up, so we will talk to you next week, hopefully.